Hello?
Welcome, Hi. This is Dave. How's everybody doing?
Good.
Great. Hi. Welcome. I wanted to announce that Chris is not going to be able to join us today. He is being honored a new book, the Dallas-Fort Worth Commercial Real Estate Hall of Fame. They're having a, he's slumming it. They're having a reception at the Dallas Country Club.
Oh, my.
So we will miss him, and we know it's going to be tough for him, but I know he'll be so glad to get back with us. And well, how are you doing? What's going on? Wins, progress notes?
I have progress notes.
Please.
I worked on the book this week, really worked on it, spent a lot of time doing the writing, and I was really, really impressed and surprised at just the insight that I got from it. You know, I've been reading it and taking notes and things as I went along, but
curriculum?
I asked, pardon me?
You're referring to the curriculum?
Yeah.
The New Money Store and Mentor Training Manual?
Yes, sir.
Okay, all right, great. I want to be sure.
Yeah, I was working on that and doing the work, answering the questions, and really just writing myself a new book on my life story. And one of the things that I found in there that really stuck with me is it says in there, you have to be in a new story before you can give up an old story. And I think that that could be a great, I don't even know what I'm thinking of.
Well, let me tell you what you're thinking. Let me expand on that a little bit while you're gathering your thoughts, because one of the most common mistakes I think we make in coaching is to add on a pattern to the ones that already exist. And things just don't work that way. You have to disrupt a current pattern and begin a new one and replace an old pattern with a new one. So In the metaphor of story, we have to create a new story and be in that old story in order to fully give up and let go of the old story. So that's what I had intended to say and emphasize. Can we do a mute of star six because of background noise, especially if you're on a cell phone or a computer phone?
It's me, yeah. Dr. Kruger. I'm gonna put on you on mute because it's gonna be noisy.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's Lynn.
Be sure and unmute when you come back to talk.
Yeah, I will.
Are there other thoughts that you were having about being in a new story before you can truly give up an old story? Now, you can have the two side by side, and for long winters, it seems at times, there's both stories until you really totally inhabit the new one, and that's the only way to truly mourn the old one, because and when you think about it from a mind-brain perspective, you're replacing the software and rewiring the brain in a new story, and you depart from the familiar pathways. Now, there may be a lot that's overlapping and similar, but it's still a new organizer. Does that make sense now?
It does.
Okay.
So I did want to let you know I'm really enjoying this, and I can see how writing that new story is so important. And I can also see how doing the work in the book for us, taking the course, it's so important for us to be able to pass it on and help others write their new story as well. So it's real important for me to be able to do that here in order to be able to teach others how to do it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that's so useful to do it ourselves, mm-hmm. and in order to really understand our story, because that way we're going to be in the best position to help a client understand his or her story and to tell it in their voice after we really tell our story in our voice, not the story we should have written 10 years ago that we think we ought to do or ought to be now, but our authentic story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, go ahead.
I like really delving into the beliefs and behaviors part of it.
Okay.
And I spend some time checking with all of the people that I was in contact with in the past week and finding out what their belief was on money, that one word. You know, what's what is that one word when you think of money, what is it? And all the ladies I talked to all came back with the same thing and boiled down to security. All the women said it was security.
Right.
I found that interesting, that we all have the same thought process on that.
Uh-huh. That is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm accustomed to seeing much more of a variation of that, but I see, of course, with mixed audiences. But that is interesting.
So that was my input this week. Thank you so much.
Well, that's great. I appreciate your reflection on what's helpful to you and where you are with things. That's a great progress note. Thanks. Now,
Thank you.
We left off. Diane was going to talk about and wanted to talk a little bit about the responsibility of money. Diane, would you pick up where we left off and didn't have time for and kind of lead our discussion there? Because I think you had some interesting points to make and things for us to think about.
Hi, Dave. I just joined. I think what I was talking about was the freedom aspect of it. In other words, the basis of this is we never have enough, and we really want to double what we do have. And yet, part of the mind shift I'm thinking is, well, look at the freedom that you have when you, number one, stop worrying so much about the money and start to focus on what it is that you do have and build upon that. So, the takeaway for me is how to, not only for yourself, but for others, to really say, look at the energy, the effort, the likelihood of doubling that, what it's doing to your life and your other goals, and take a step back. And when you let go of that, look at the freedom that you have to focus on your other priorities. So that was my question, is can we begin to look at the freedom that we do have as opposed to, the quest for more, and sometimes more is actually less.
That's an incredible juxtaposition to look at. The fantasy is that freedom is acquired by incredible money, and you're reversing that to say a true freedom is to not be preoccupied with money and to have a sense of what enough is, because that's the only way you can arrive somewhere is to know where you're going and know what enough is, because if it's more, you'll never get there, and you'll never be totally free or totally satisfied. So the trick is also to not set the bar lower than it could be, or move up the finish line and say you finished the race. To not justify not creating exactly what you want in your full capacity, depending on your own ideals and your own needs, but then to know what that is when you arrive, so that you can feel satisfaction and acquire and maintain both the freedom and all the emotional aspects that hitchhike on money as well as money. So I think you really put something very profound in a very succinct way about looking at freedom in both directions.
Yes, and for me personally, I have found that opportunities that I have, college-age kids, and when they go to, in programs where there's a lot less money and they really donate their time and their skill set, whatever that is, they get back so much more than you would anticipate. But the meaning of it very often is the little things that they have the opportunity to give them back, whether it's jewelry, whether it's a smile, whether it's a hug, whether it's running to the airport and saying thank you so much, et cetera. That is such a take-home for understanding how we get really crippled with this search for more, whether it's security, as we've said before. But when you are among a culture of people that they're so happy just for your time to play with them, mm-hmm. to show them, it's
uh-huh.
amazing.
Yeah, that's so true. That's a great point and a great illustration of that. And in a sort of related way, you have to be free to say yes before no has any meaning. and vice versa. So
yes.
to truly have a freedom with and about money, you have to look at all the things that it represents and be sure that what you're really talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Great points. Yeah, super. Thank you. Other progress notes or things to discuss. How are you finding the actress? Go ahead.
It's Lynn here. Hopefully
yeah,
it's not too noisy. I just reading the material, I came across a couple of things that's part of my plot, I guess. And it's very insightful, actually, to really dig deep and really see where my story came from. And yes, I recall vividly that there was never enough in my upbringing, but there was also something that I became more familiar with just recently in the past few days with my handling of money in my bank accounts and that. And it's almost like I have a sneaky way of, oh, I'm going to do this. Oh, what if my husband does something? And then I check the account. Oh, he did that. What is he doing? It's almost like I'm trying to control it and also be a little bit devious in my spending without him knowing what I'm doing, you know? So I think we need to work on that as far as our communication between each other with money, and obviously that comes from somewhere where there was no communication.
Well, that's interesting because you're really highlighting what money is expressing for each of you, and you know whose money is it? Money is it yours? Is it his? Does it represent freedom and autonomy for you to be able to make some decisions distinct from his? And do you need to keep that distinct in order to preserve it? I mean, there are a lot of questions that you're raising, that you're highlighting, just in being aware of that. So then I think that's very insightful and very open and honest to say that.
Yeah, it was really funny. I kind of laughed at myself when I was saying, oh, what are you doing? Like, you know, he's taking up that money. What is he doing with it? I was going to text him, and then I thought, no, where am I doing this? attack him, and then here I am doing the same, you know. So.
Well, I mean, you know, you remind me of something that was just so subliminal. It wasn't unconscious. There are a lot of things that aren't unconscious that I wish were much more unconscious. But my wife is doing a seminar series at Yale right now. She's doing the master's and PhD program at Texas A&M, but she's at Yale right now. So I thought, oh, great. I'll order my really expensive cigars so they arrive when she's gone, and I'll put them in, and I'll act like they've been there all along. So, yeah. So knowing about the unconscious does not grant you immunity from it, or knowing a story does not give you a pristine.
No, but it makes you more responsible, though.
I know. Yeah, exactly. Great point. Other thoughts, other things? Are you finding a carryover as yet? I know we're only two seminars into it and some reading in addition to that, but are you finding any different ways of listening to clients? And I realize we're just starting on the roadmap process, so I don't expect anything profound, even if it were to come, that it's early. But I hear how each of you are saying that it affects really listening to and illuminating your own story and sharpening the focus on it.
I'm becoming more aware of some people's conversations around money, like my coworkers, a lot of talk about the stock market and like how it's going up and up and up. And the former CEO at our company, CN, is now at CP, and the stock is skyrocketing ever since he's been there. So there's I kind of just I'm kind of more tuned in. I was always tuned in because I always have that side of me that wants to, you know, take that chance and buy. But more tuned in to some of the other workers who are kind of not so tuned in to it and are not paying no mind to it, you know? So, yeah, I'm kind of noticing things that I never noticed before as to how people are talking about money and whether they're comfortable about it or, you know, they're just, just talking to talk.
Yeah, exactly. And so many things are totally okay to talk about until you get to something really personal, like income or like debt. But economies and stock market and all kinds of things, the cost of houses and all kinds of economic and financial scenarios are totally okay to talk about because they're out there. And
yeah.
They require no revealing of anything really personal.
One of the things that I found that's really interesting is how many women, relative to what you're saying about security, but several women that I've actually spoken with this week, when it comes to the day-to-day, they really like to be very much in control of the expenses. Yet there seems to be this relationship when it comes to retirement income or down the road that they don't want to take responsibility for that. It's amazing. Time and time again, I've seen this, and it always surprises me. I think, yet it goes back to the same idea of, well, what really is the goal? What's the priority? You know, but they completely want to micromanage the little expenses and the day-to-day, yet, oh, the money manager takes care of the retirement, or, you know, it's just, I don't want to bother my head with that, yet that's really the bigger picture, you know? And it feeds right into what I think we're really discussing, that it's such a big topic, but it's one that very often women say, I won't take responsibility for. You know, that's the man's job, or someone else is in charge of that.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I wonder if there is a gender specificity there in a traditional model that's at play. Mm-hmm. Because what you're describing is that women are particularly focused on saving and on spending money and really managing that aspect. And that may be the aspect that they feel most effectiveness. Everything that we do is governed by wanting to be effective and wanting to experience mastery. Now, sometimes the domains are so narrowed, or sometimes the context is so extreme or skewed that effectiveness takes on a particular shape. You know, as an example, I have never seen a psychological symptom in 25 years of practice that did not have at some point in development an adaptive intent and context. In other words, what somebody had to do to manage or be effective in, say, a particular family was to create a symptom. Like the young woman who was bulimic, the only way that she could regulate her feeling and her state of mind was to use food to do it. The anorexic, the only thing she felt control of in her entire family was what she put into and didn't put into her mouth. So everything looked at had an adaptive intent. Now, and that was the key to success in working with these people, to understand what the adaptive intent was so that there could be other adaptive intents looked at rather than approaching it from the side of pathology, which resulted in, you know, people shutting down and not getting better and feeling everybody was critical and things not working. So here, I wonder if the adaptive context is, that's the domain of what the women you're describing are in charge of, which is spending. They're not in charge of earning. They're not in charge of a bigger picture of asset allocation and game planning for things like retirement. So they move to what they're effective in doing.
Mm-hmm.
Or what they feel effective in doing, what their model is, because they don't have a model that incorporates, you know, the big picture of, you know, financial planning for retirement involves income. You look at what the income is going to be and then how to allocate that. That's not the domain in which they may have functioned to generate the income from what you're describing. And this is a subset, of course.
Well, interesting, even single women that have provided for that haven't been married, it was the same it was the same mindset, and that's why I started piecing them together. And I was like, wow, that is like so amazing, you know.
Uh-huh.
Part of it is we need to work through this cultural issue, but there was similarities between women that had been working full time and women that had been managing, you know, the household, et cetera.
Yeah. It really takes a while or some specific work to look at and understand and write different stories from the downloads that came from early on about how parents viewed money, how society at the time you grew up viewed money, what money meant and what it didn't, what you could and couldn't do with it, how people were regarded who had more or less, the individual attributions of money by each of the parents, how they dealt with you with, you know, with money. So there are a whole lot of models that just come to be accepted in the way things are without even consciously being aware of them. And I think each of you are talking now about eliminating the models that we operate on, the beliefs and the attachment and behavior patterns that we can be aware of and then really address about how to go about changing that. And that's really what we're going to be doing with the roadmap system, a way of understanding, a way of deconstructing and understanding an existing story and creating a systematic way to revise or create a new one, you know, sort of element by element, mind, brain, and behavior. And I think that's where you're going to be so incredibly effective and powerful as coaches, to really know the building blocks of how to do this, how to help someone create change when they've been stuck before, even in coaching scenarios, and how to make changes that last, how to make them permanent as well as effective. And I think you're going to do a lot with it, and I really respect and enjoy hearing you talk about your own discoveries of your own money story, because that's a great place to begin. Anything else you'd like to touch on before we move into the material? Okay, well, again, feel free to interrupt me at any time or add something you'd like to. If there's a discussion we get into, if there's something I don't cover, I'll dictate from my outline and send it on. So don't hesitate. Now, we're going to talk about inscribing new code and beginning a process with that this time. We've talked about the concept of your money story, your relationship with money, and the first three steps of that story of change, how to recognize, own, and assess your story. Now we're going to look at how to inscribe new code, steps 4 and 5. So step 4, decide what to change in your money story. I'm going to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact. I think I know Lynn has heard this, but I don't think others of you have heard this. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from poles of contrasting behavior, like lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive. They would choose one of these and then behave according to this the entire day. And in addition to that, twice a week, they would eat something they had never eaten before and read something they had never read before. So after 4 months just of doing this for basically I think it was a five-hour period of the day that they volunteered to do this, what do you think was the biggest change in this group? What's your guess? Take a wild guess. Take a chance. Any guesses? Well, the remarkable finding was that after 4 months, the subjects had lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost all had kept the weight off. And this wasn't a diet, but it was a study focusing on change and the impact of change. The rationale, requiring people to change routine behavior makes them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. They became aware that everything they did, every piece of behavior, was a choice. Ultimately, they became aware that every bite of food they took was a choice. So they began to be aware of, is this the right choice for me? Is this in my best interest? So it reduced every action to choice, which is exactly what we strive to do in coaching, in one sense. So once becoming aware of actively making choices, you decide to make the most informed and strategic choices possible. And, of course, if you want to understand something, try to change it. So I want to talk a little bit about choice now and choice architecture in terms of the dynamics of change. Now, despite being presented with ample evidence of how change will be beneficial, many people simply don't make change even when they know it's in their best interest. An example, a study of coronary bypass patients fresh on the intensive care unit, when their lives are at risk, unless they adopt healthier lifestyles, especially in terms of nutrition and exercise, and they're told, they're educated, how many people, what percent of people change their habits? Only 1 in 9 actually change when their life depends on it, when they are totally informed, and they've had a really scary, life-threatening precipitant. Now, remember, your identity is not your behavior or your habits. A habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it'll be harder to change, as we've talked before. Now, last seminar, we discussed the equation, belief drives behavior, behavior drives performance. So for this step, decide what to change, I want to add an equation. It captures the principle that you either create your reality or you agree to it. Event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience in life is a result of how you respond to an event in your life. Achievement is an outcome. It's the result of responding in particular ways. It's not what happens to us, but our response to what happens to us that makes the difference for the things that we don't determine externally. Now, once more, remember this essential principle for ownership of your story. In adulthood, you either create or allow everything that happens to you. You worked out, so now you feel more energy and alertness. You didn't attend to marketing, and now your business is slumping. You've spent more than you've earned, and we call that debt. Choice is part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is also a mindset with its own text, and this is how that sounds. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen. I don't think I can do it. The awareness of the absence of choice limits possibility. Now, a footnote here. Whatever you're doing that you can't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior, a person, or spending money beyond your means to a process like debt. Money is energy. Anyone addicted to anything has difficulty regulating energy. And an addiction, and I heard this described at the financial therapy conference that I attended just recently and did the keynote, that an addiction can be described as when a behavior becomes the controlling organizer. When a behavior becomes the central organizing factor of your life. So that's why it can be a substance, a process, a person, a behavior, anything that becomes centrally organizing your life. Money is energy. Anyone addicted to anything has difficulty regulating energy. Now, I want to talk talk for a moment about obstacles and desires. And here's a notion I'd like you to consider. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. Let me say that a different way. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. For example, show me clutter, I'll show you blocked energy, the desire's release. We always create the outside to match the inside. In other words, a client presents an obstacle. Rather than strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat or simply obliterate an obstacle, simply consider not creating it. You're writing that as part of your story as every other aspect. It's there when you create it. Consider using your energy to generate something else instead. Now, there's a secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it safe to want if you're afraid. Let me give you an example. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking fiercely at a cat, as if to say, just let me at him. Next frame showed the cat, really a tough cat, as big as the dog, and looked very mean itself. All of a sudden, in the next frame, in the middle of a very ferocious bark, just let me at him, the leash snapped, so the dog was free to go after the cat. No more obstacle. He looked back, saw it, looked astonished, scared to death. He quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, and tied a triple knot. Then he could again strain safely at the leash and bark his fiery, just let me at him. Now, another example of this dialectic of obstacle and desire, and this is commonplace. When viewing a scene in the film you don't want to see, you cover your face with your hands as if to say, no, I don't want to look. But then the desire creeps in and you peek through your fingers at what you're drawn to see. The obstacle makes looking acceptable. So, here's the key for coaching. When you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, for example, I can't find time to exercise, I can't put away any savings, every one of these are coachable moments for me, reflect on the underlying desire. And this is the principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like to not create your obstacles. Also, if you have a problem or an obstacle, sometimes it's helpful to draw it out. Drawing is about relationships and seeing it as a whole. So here are some things, then, that neuroscience teaches us about mentoring and change that I want to put here, especially as we're looking at deciding what to change. One, people have prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way. In other words, we have to begin with where the client is, then go someplace new. The prior knowledge, as we've discussed, is physical, real, and persistent, as neuronal pathways and networks in the brain. One of the challenges of change is that you just can't present a fact or an experience or a better way of doing something and have it replace what's already there. When you know a fact or have a belief, as we've discussed, they're both anatomical realities in your brain. Simply overlaying another fact or belief won't overwrite what's already there because the anatomical structure is still there. It's related to why just adding a pattern to the patterns that already exist is not going to work. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. Four, partly because it's complex and personal and partly because it's subjective reality, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. Remember, 90 to 95% of our operating systems are unconscious. Five, mentor coaching is about recognizing the process and to assess where changes are necessary. When changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. And six, the mentor-coaching relationship is one of collaborative, contingent conversations. This capacity relies in part on mirror neurons in which we experience others through our sensory resonance and ourselves, our own intuitive and empathic abilities. Mirror neurons and the mirroring capacity allows us to use intuitive perception in what we do. So, and this is where I especially want to focus about change, change and the brain. This, I believe, is really crucial to understand when we engage change, because so many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Now, both our minds and our brains automatically resist change. So let's first look at how the brain opposes change and then how to use this information to facilitate success. So since the brain has a mind of its own, we need to consider how our brains work, and each of these 10 precepts, I believe, will help you craft a new money story, a new story, life, career, bit, whatever, for yourself and your clients. The mechanisms are a little complex, but the principles are so simple, they're almost elusive. So 10 principles of how the brain operates to facilitate change. This is in your outline. 1, change generates discomfort. Part of the reason for the resistance to change is due to the fact that it's way more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we've repeated, that have become habits, become hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brains, have become etched by repeated habits to create an efficient operation, to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about the way we drive to work the same day, drive the same way to work every day. And because of this default mode, we can think about other things or listen to a book. And this default mode, this wiring, self-wiring by the brain, is energy efficient and takes way less energy, and the brain's freed up to do other things. When these habits are confronted and have to change, not only does it move someone out of the comfort zone, but the automatic pilots in the midbrain get disrupted. We feel discomfort. And the prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. So it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and to preserve the default habit. So the brain naturally resists change. And remember, the error detection mechanism also is a warning to resist change. The brain naturally resists change to hardwire behavior, saves energy, so it opposes, change opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary standpoint. Now, the promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. Beliefs turn genes on and turn them off. One of my most stimulating, not easiest to read, authors, Ray Kurzweil, and this is a quote from "The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology." He put it, I think, very succinctly. He said, "Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them." 2. Change creates dissonance. We see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. It's located in the medial frontal cortex, right next to the emotional center of the brain. The brain has this innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors. It's the difference between what we expect and what we actually perceive. It registers is a sense that something's not quite right. At times it can be really abrupt and explicit. Remember, for example, maybe a time that you sort of were thinking about something else, went to the refrigerator, took a drink of milk, and then suddenly you realized it was orange juice and abruptly discovered that, you know, kind of in a startled way. Now, this portion of your brain has the job description to recognize and correct errors. So consider, and this is kind of a sidebar, but consider the emotional expense of a couple of things in terms of the error detection mechanism that it participates. A lie. The surface story is the constructed lie, so you got to work at it to start with. The subliminal story is the recognition of a lie by the error detection mechanism. So your brain is also doing double work. Then you have to deal with the dissonance, triple work. Consider one more, debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is very simple. You have to pay more for it. Then the emotional expense of your mind and dissonance in your brain to recognize that you bought something you can't afford or you didn't have money for. You know, you can segment and be in the excitement part of the spending, but then you segment the pain of payment and relegate it to a different part of your brain. Then you have to pay the interest. Again, triple work. You can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. Now, the good news here, this neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior. This is where we come in as coaches. So we also respond to mistakes. This is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or simply a neural response and printout to change itself. Now, we're going to return to this in a few minutes when we talk about the next step about mapping change. 3, the brain is a prediction machine. If you have a pen, let me tell you some numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. What's missing? Usual
3 and 6.
3 and 6, maybe multiples of 3. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. Here's an example. A company has increased profits 26 quarters in a row, earnings per share, with projected earnings growth for this quarter to 24 cents per share, which is an increase from the previous quarter. They announce earnings, instead of 24 cents, they announce earnings of 23 cents. In the next 5 minutes, they lose $1.5 billion in market value. Now, what changed in those 5 minutes? The company's intrinsic value and balance sheet, or the mindset of the investors? Simply because some analysts didn't do their math right, or didn't have the accurate information. One more example. J. Paul Getty said that there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. Now you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of some jokes. Listing 2 things, then a 3rd non sequitur. Set up, payoff. Seinfeld is especially good at this. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make balanced decisions. So we need to be sure that we predict, that we envision the right thing. 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO, Chief Operating Officer of a company, determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show 2 things. Threats work short term, but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. Remember from quantum physics, you get what you focus on, not what you want. And when you focus on lateness, even in the positive or the negative way, you still bring about what you don't want. Now, we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Obviously, not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. It's the brain pushing back, kind of like a two-year-old. So that's why instruction or telling a client what to do usually doesn't work, because also if it's something outside the scope of what they think is reasonable or what they're accustomed to, their error detection mechanism is going to say, no way. The brain's natural homeostasis says avoid change. So that's why we have to begin where someone is and then go step by step to a new place. Five, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. Now, you're talking to a former psychoanalyst for over 20 years, and psychoanalysis is a theory of motivation. So this is a huge departure. You probably heard clients say, well, I need to get motivated to exercise. I need to get motivated to lose weight. You don't have to be motivated. Sometimes setting a goal will enhance motivation, just as having a strategy will enhance attention and concentration. But you don't have to be motivated. All you have to have or do is to have a plan and stick to it. If we have time at the end, I want to do an exercise, kind of a neuroscience demonstration with you, how motivation is not necessary to bring about change. You don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. You make one good decision, you set up an automatic payment or participation plan. You only need to make a good choice one time, and the quality of many future years can depend on that. But again, you don't have to be motivated, just a plan, and then you can set up where you automatically stick to it. Six, emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, the brain chemicals of dopamine and adrenaline are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. This is why self-talk is limited. You know, change your thoughts to change your behavior may work until emotion gets activated. As soon as emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. And I think I quoted him before. One of the philosophers of the 21st century put it really simply: everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Mike Tyson said that. When there is a possibility of reward or even of spending money, dopamine is released to produce an excited state in response to anticipation of a reward or of spending or of making money. A risky stock investment, approaching a slot machine or blackjack table. Here's what we know now. It's not the reward that causes the spike in dopamine, and that's what we thought it was for a long time. That, yeah, when you do something that you know, stimulus response, you get, you do something, you get a reward, and it enhances the probability of doing it. But what we know now, it's the anticipation of reward. When gamblers were studied, their excitement, their spike in dopamine occurred as they approached the slot machine before they ever touched it. And this is something that I sort of came to in working with eating disorder individuals, and this came to be true of every kind of addiction, as I ask many, many people this. There's not a single one of several hundred young women who were bulimic who indicated anything other than this. I would ask, at what point in eating, and I would go through, you know, the sequence of what the internal conversation was to result in the decision to eat, and then what, and ask, at what point did your state of mind, did your mood change in that process? Inevitably, 100% of them said, before the food ever touched my mouth. Same with drinking, same with drugs, same with the anticipation of any kind of exciting activity. Secondly, the less predictable a reward is, the longer and stronger the dopamine neurons fire, creating more of a natural high. And you remember this from college psychology probably. if a laboratory mouse is given regular predictable reward for pushing a lever, the behavior stops quickly when the food pellet reward stops. But if the pellets are infrequent and unpredictable, in other words, irregularly, intermittent reward, the mouse will keep pushing the lever almost indefinitely until fatigue or death. This behavior now is not confined to laboratory mice. Watch Bank of Slot Machines in Las Vegas, and you'll see the same scenario, complete with lever pulling and reward pellets. Now, the moral is people fall easily into the unconscious pursuit of dopamine and its accompanying pleasure, despite the obviously illogical downside. Think about what happens if you ever play the slot machine or watch somebody. Think about when the brain predicts a third recurrence, and they have neuroscientists on contract to consult with gaming companies. I'm not one of them, but whenever you see, you know, like, let's use a simple example: the slot machine that has, you know, when you get three cherries, you get the big reward. There'll be, you know, one cherry, and then the second row, the second cherry, and then, oh man, just one more, hey, I've hit big time. And then you almost get it and it stops one short or goes one beyond. Nobody in their right mind is going to be able to stop. They're on a dopamine fire, and they're going to continue, and they're going to continue until their money's gone. And they know exactly how often to program those near misses and stimulate that behavior. Research shows that it's the anticipation of reward that's actually more satisfying than receiving it, because attaining the goal shuts down the chemical engine of anticipation and the high that goes with it. Looking forward to the big win or the big purchase can be more thrilling than actually getting it. This can contribute to buyer's remorse, as well as the almost ubiquitous experience that a new purchase isn't as exciting as you anticipated. And think about it. The chemical engine of anticipation is the sprint system. You're getting all excited about something. And then when you purchase something, that shuts off and you go to the chemical system of the marathon system, which is norepinephrine. You know, I just got back from getting a new car, so I'm waiting for it to hit, but I think I've laddered it where it's not going to hit me. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of stress short term enhance learning. Now, the time window on this phenomenon is about 2 hours, up to 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially by the time you get to 3 or 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. This means that with sustained stress, people make bad, emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy is regulation of states of mind. That's why we're going to spend an entire seminar on that, and that there's an entire module on that. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place and one position get most entrenched. You know, another place that I see this resistance in coaching, especially using this principle, is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he started 36 years ago to his 2 children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles and relationships. There's the individual resistance of mind and brain plus the collective resistance of the system, the family. Now, these last 2 principles, I think, are really huge for coaching and for our lives. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. What we know now, 2 things above all others create new brain cells, create neurogenesis: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment includes things like intellectual and emotional stimulation that creates more complex brain structure to co-create, to stimulate thinking, to challenge, to story bust, exactly what we do in coaching. Now, the hippocampus, remember, is the part of the brain that is connected with attaching meaning, it's also connected most of any part of the brain to creativity and memory. It's really the locus of most creativity and memory because it's where we attach meaning. Mice from an enriched environment, and they figured out ways to do this, have a 15% increase in the number of hippocampal cells. Now, what's your guess about how much exercise increases the actual number of cells in the hippocampus? Physical exercise increases almost 100% the number of cells in the hippocampus. Now, there have been human studies, non-invasive studies, that have replicated this finding more recently in medical students at the University of Hamburg and taxi drivers in London. Now, a related finding, chronic stress, release of cortisol, impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus, creativity and memory, decline with chronic stress. 10, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons, rezoning, and developing cortical real estate. So when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. One illustration of this, some NASA astronauts, that's just down the road a piece from where I am, did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that gave an upside-down image consistently 24 hours a day. In other words, everything was reversed, so they had to so carefully plan and strategize for every movement because they had to think through, then reverse, then do the act. After being in this apparatus for 25 days, they noticed something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustments. They didn't have to. Their brains had developed new pathways. Another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off out of the helmets at day 15 for 24 hours. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on for their brains to rewire. So this emphasizes, I think, at least for simple behavior response things, the importance of consistency and continuity. Now, step 5, map changes. So let's talk about mapping, figuring out the map for a new story. A man approached J.P. Morgan, held up an envelope, and said, "Sir, in my hand I hold a guaranteed formula for success, which I will gladly sell you for $25,000. And that was back in the day when $25,000 really meant something. "Sir," J.P. Morgan said, "I don't know. May I get a mute, please? Need a mute. I think someone's walked away from our phone. Get a mute. Thank you. "Sir," J.P. Morgan replied, "I don't know what's in the envelope. However, if you show it to me and I like it, I give you my word as gentleman, I'll pay you what you ask." The man agreed to the terms, considering the options, and handed over the envelope. J.P. Morgan opened it, extracted a single piece of paper, gave it one look, just a mere glance, and handed the piece of paper back to the man, wrote him a check for $25,000. There were two sentences on the page. "Every morning, write a list of things that need to be done that day. Do them." Let me ask if you would to do a mute. I can put us on lecture mode, but I'd rather leave it open for discussion. Are you there and hearing? I'm going to put us on mute. I'll wrap up and then we'll come back for discussion. The human brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing search for meaning. These patterns, mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. When our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, the patterns become automatic, so we don't have to think about them. They're hardwired and automatic. So lingering, unsolved, and unresolved stories in our heads create an emotional drain. Unresolved loops in our head are part of that emotional drain. So one scenario in mentor coaching is when a client is given unfamiliar advice, the uncertainty sets off the error detection mechanisms, as I've mentioned. So someone can reject the idea before consideration, before even collaborating to create a map, placing another barrier to resist change. Now, the error detection mechanism is so prevalent, and consider how everyday it is. We notice differences more easily than confirmation, so it becomes easier to focus on the things we do wrong while struggling to list our strengths. Focusing on problems energizes because it activates the error detection mechanism. Bad news gets our attention for the same reason, things that, news that bleeds leads. And think about how even a road accident causes people to stop and stare as the unexpected commands attention. So the automatic patterns and related belief system, the very mechanisms that allow fluid function in the world, are all examples of our mental maps. Mental maps become our unconscious operating manual. Now, they're tailor-made for certain contexts in our lives, some of which make it very efficient, very effective, but some of those contexts come from an earlier time, and they were tailored for an earlier time or setting. This is where we need to highlight the recognition, the ownership, and the assessment of those storylines to map new changes. The hardwiring is not permanent, so mentor coaching is a way of rewiring the brain and revising the software. So I want to just go over six crucial elements to map change. We'll talk about how to understand and incorporate each of the six, an outline to master your money story. One, regulate states of mind. Now, since we're going to spend an entire seminar on this, I just want to highlight this and give you an example. Dr. Vernon Smith won a Nobel Prize in economics, in part by demonstrating how market bubbles are created. He did a series of trading experiments with economic graduate students now. They were informed that the fair value of a security was $3. Now, that's significantly different than the stock market, because the stock market isn't really a market. It's an auction. And the stock is worth whatever somebody's willing to pay for it. But these people were told the actual value. They got into bidding, and in price bidding, they ran the price up significantly past the $3 mark to the high $5 range in each of the experiments. When other traders in the experiment stopped paying a premium, the market crashed. Same group, second time, same bubble except smaller. They ran it into the low fours until it crashed. It wasn't until the third time that they really wised up and recognized what was happening in their minds and brains, that they were creating an artificial market. And this was repeated. Smith repeated this with economic specialists and practitioners and financial people. They did the same thing. And we're going to talk about that more in states of mind. The bubbles weren't as extreme, but they were still there twice before they came back to be only the value of the stock. It's kind of the equivalent of when it crashes of the kid who said, well, you know, the emperor doesn't really have any clothes on. So this is what I'm talking about in terms of the influence of states of mind. States of mind are like software programs. They're a mind-body state that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and how we respond. We each have a whole range of different states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention. And a key element is to be aware of our different states of mind and know which state works best for what purpose. So we're going to talk about that at length, because I think it's really crucial in Seminar 6. The number two element to map changes: the power is in the focus. This is the neuroscience and quantum physics behind the law of attraction. Thoughts have a frequency and energy field. Focus selects that frequency. It's like saying all the channels of a radio or satellite TV are available. We choose the channel, the frequency we want, out of hundreds of possibilities. We each transmit and receive a frequency through our thoughts. So if you want to change something in your life, change the frequency, the channel, change your thoughts. Now, the bad news, if you think about what you don't want, it keeps showing up over and over. Now, this is a principle. There are actually two principles here. According to quantum physics, we each generate energy frequencies or vibrations. The quantum Zeno effect, Z-E-N-O, says the mental act of attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. It's really like aligning a magnetic field to point it in one direction when you focus. With consistent focus and repetition, these links actually become stable changes in the brain structure. The brain rewires. Now, quantum physics offers us still another paradigm. In addition to our individual energy field, there is a collective field. Einstein called this the unified field theory. Basically, he said the human mind and body is a bundle of energy and interacts with another person's energy field. And when we're with a group, it acts with that collective energy field. So this is how we engage in an energetic way, and like a magnet, attract what we focus on. If we focus on the negative and on problems, that'll be what we create. If we focus on the positive and on solutions, that'll be what we create. So we have to be sure also that our actions are in alignment with our thinking and not leave that part out. Now, the paradox is that we don't attract what we want. We attract what we focus on. Everybody wants more money, so wanting is not the key to having it. Focusing on scarcity attracts scarcity. Focusing on prosperity aligns your energy field to produce or pursue prosperity. Now, the essence of this is that your unconscious doesn't register positive or negative, just the focus. It's kind of like saying a print and a negative is the same image. Your unconscious is that image. So the power of focus is whatever you attend to or focus on, you align yourself to create. So be sure you focus on the right thing. Here are some bad examples. I want to get out of debt. Focus is on debt, the negative. I want to lose weight. Same thing. And here's one that's kept a lot of dry cleaners busy. I want to be really careful and not spend some, not spill something on this new outfit. And Dr. Joseph Murray summarizes this very succinctly. Your subconscious mind does not argue with you. It accepts what your conscious mind decrees. If you say, I can't afford it, your subconscious mind works to make it true. 3, visualize changes. There's an entire chapter of the ebook, Outsmart Your Brain Instruction Manual, that I'm going to send you on visualizing changes. And it goes through in a systematic way of how to create a visualization, which is a way of rewiring the brain, and affirmations, which is a way of creating a story that supports that. Just a brief illustration of that. One of the prototype studies of this, basketball players at Ohio State were divided into 3 groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. Second group, 30 minutes of practice daily. And the third group practiced imagining shooting perfect free throws, nothing but net, and that at least 5 minutes daily for 30 days. They were tested at the end of 30 days. The first group, no practice, 0% improvement. Second group, actual practice for 30 minutes daily, 24% improvement. The third group, practice by visualization only, 23% improvement. And subsequent studies have shown the visualization to be even more effective than actual practice because you don't have to make it, and then the ones you miss, you have to recalibrate and all that. It's pure focus on exactly what grooves the brain. So visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea, and the experience changes the brain. And I'll send you that, and there's some material in the curriculum also about constructing a vision. Now, the fourth principle, insight changes the brain. We've already talked about this, about how an aha moment, a moment of insight, creates a lighting up of 3 different parts of the brain to vault someone into a more synthetic and integrative, more creative state of mind. So, and they're able to think beyond where they were before. A complex new set of neural connections is created. And this aha releases chemicals that sustains this experience. Contrast that when somebody's given information, a directive, an order, nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. Now, as important as insight-induced change is, sustained action is what hardwires it into the brain circuits. Now, this is the fifth step, the fifth principle. Take action. The world won't pay you for what you know. It'll pay you for what you do. And six, transform identity. A new experience or an idea has to be focused on consistently and frequently and also incorporated into one's story. And this is the essence, and this is what we'll cover in the P of the Roadmap. The most powerful force of the human psyche, as we've talked before, is to return to our core identity. So if we simply change behavior and don't change our identity, the model of what we're operating on, how we're operating, then we'll revert back and the change will be lost. So that's why at every step we want to look at helping someone understand and evolve their model of their of how they're operating to parallel the changes that they're making in behavior. So this is step seven, program new identity. So we'll come back to that. Now, I was planning to have a lot more discussion time, but let me just summarize some specific steps to help clients change mind, brain, and behavior, kind of a summary of these two steps. Begin with where the client is. Help them learn more about what they already know. Highlight positive attributes, in other words, existing neuronal networks like natural talents, behaviors, patterns, to encourage their practice. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus is going to enhance neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing positive networks. So, let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. Encourage the client to develop their own metaphors and connections. Story or co-create those together. Stories, analogies, and metaphors create new maps. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel situations. You have to recognize and take ownership of your experience as a first step. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. So, give attention to a new experience or a new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. We're in discussion mode now. Sorry, I needed to mute, but someone had walked away and we were hearing some noise, and it was distracting. So we have far less time than I'd hoped for your thoughts, discussions, and questions. What are your thoughts about this material and its usefulness for you? Does it make sense, first of all?
For me, it's Lynn here. Absolutely. It makes a whole lot of sense. There's a lot of information to digest, but...
I know.
Yeah, but it makes a whole lot of sense. Yeah, it's very great how it's kind of systematically put, so you know exactly, like at the end when you summarized it, you basically gave us steps to use in order to help a client.
And again, nothing is ever as clear as for purposes of discussion. So the idea of this is that you metabolize it and it becomes your story. It becomes an informed position that you're operating from, but not any kind of model that you're trying to fit into. Something then that you can use the principles as ways of organizing how you're thinking and how you're collaborating to facilitate the work with a client. Not something to think back to and think, well, how do I need to say it in terms of this? Just, you know.
Good point. That's good.
I was, and let me illustrate this. I was working back in the day when I was working as a therapist and an analyst. I worked with an artist who was regionally known, and he wanted to work together because he really wanted to kind of quieten some demons. What he was afraid of is that it would also quieten his creativity, and what he understood for that aspect ultimately was that he was free to be not only as creative but more creative, and really was able to soar as an artist to become internationally known. What he described is what I want to convey to you about this process. What he described in terms of how he put it in terms of his art. And he said, you know, when I go to a canvas and I emote and I get in the zone and create, I don't think about this, and he was an abstract expressionist, I don't think about this gesture means this color means this shape means this. If I were to step back in a different state of mind and look at any component, I could deconstruct that. And I've taken 15 years of training before my years of experience, years of training in, you know, anatomy, color, composition, line art, abstract, you know, a whole number of things. And I could deconstruct that and tell you what that meant in terms of a particular concept. But I'm using it, and I'm not thinking about it because I'm in the zone of emoting. I could only tell you what it means after the fact. And that's the kind of experience that I think you'll come to have, is you'll use this material in a way that it just informs you. It becomes a fluid synthesis. It's not like, well, what would Kruger have said here? Now, I know that position because it you know, the first two or three jams I got into at practicing my first year and as a psychiatrist, I thought, God, what would Herb Schlesinger say right now? You know? So I understand that, but I hope the story illustrates how once it becomes metabolized by you, it just becomes part of your substrate, part of your essence, and you can use it in a way that will enhance what you do, but not to sort of have to reconstruct the elements of it or use a, you know, a template. Does that make sense?
Yep, that makes absolute sense.
Terrific. Okay, well, I'm sorry we didn't have more discussion. I'll try to be much more tight. That's probably when I operate from an outline and sort of elaborate, I'll get too strung out. But I'll manage the time a little bit better next time. Thank you all very much, and I look forward to picking up right here next time. Bye now. Have a great day.